Kaya Talk on Kaya 959.
On the street, on the air.
We continue our conversations around what does the future hold for this country. Dr. Paddy Mulihotla is a former statistician general and member of Indlulamati, and they have been working on scenario planning. And I'm very, very interested in seeing whether what we see right now, Dr. Lehotla, was this one of the scenarios that we had planned out?
Well, let us see, not planned out, but constructed. Three scenarios were constructed. Mm-hmm. And importantly, following a path is a choice. Even if you are not deliberate in choosing that path, its outcome and the destination that you reach reduces it to a choice that you have made, that you end up in that. So, yes, what we are seeing, which is a nation in despair, was one of those scenarios. And we labeled it a guara-guara, which is a land of despair and a demoralized land and a land of disorder and decay. And I think what we are seeing now is exactly that. We had said such a scenario will eventuate if certain deliberate measures are undertaken. And those measures are not an accident. They are purposeful, mm-hmm. and they are followed through with energy. If we think about what is happening at Zondo Commission, mm-hmm. it's not an accident. People are purposefully following the idea and the activity of looting, destroying infrastructure altogether. The 12 years of unity talks in the ANC that eventuated not in that unity fulfilled that purpose. This thing played out before us. 8 motions of no confidence failed in parliament, suggesting that parliamentary democracy is a farce when citizens are not active. So when you take all that together, including with a degenerating economy with growth ranging about 1%, meant all that was heading to a guara-guara scenario. Not to mention the high unemployment of particularly the youth. And in this regard, if you took the youth from 15 to 34 years, between 2008 and 2020 now, I mean, the Statistician General released unemployment figures for 2021. When you look at those figures between 2008 and now, the youth, in absolute terms and proportionately, have lost their share of employment. And those who are 35 and above have crept into those employment that used to belong to the youth. In 2016, I released a report that I presented, and I said the young people are performing worse than their parents. And that meant there is no progress. If the future generations are performing worse than the predecessor generation, it means that we are heading really to a guara-guara scenario. And therefore, among the three outcomes or scenarios, South Africa sees the guara-guara scenario at this stage. Mm. Now, scenarios are not new. Mm. They are not new in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Scenarios are not new. And an important point has to be made that they actually, when you follow how they were constructed, mm-hmm. and followed through, they yielded specific results, mm-hmm. but it required leadership to pay attention, mm-hmm. To that design. Unfortunately, From 2008, there were no scenarios in the country. Therefore, we were moving blind. If you think about the settlement in South Africa in 1994, it was driven largely by the emergence of what was the Montflair scenarios. And those gifted us a particular settlement. And in the settlement, the question was whether it will be will there be a settlement? If there is a settlement, will it be fast enough? If it is fast enough, will it yield a sustainable economic and social growth? Those were the three questions that were asked in succession. There was a settlement. It was quick enough. The question was, will it yield a sustainable economy and social benefits? Yes, I think there were things that didn't go too well in terms of economy, because between 1996, economic growth was very low. And in 2003, government decided to launch scenarios called the Memories of the Future. These scenarios yielded a program that was called ASGISA. With the implementation of ASGISA, you saw South Africa's growth going up to 4.8% on average between 2004 up to 2008. And unemployment, which was at 30% by about 2001, 2002, dropped to about 20%, a percentage that was still high. But you could see the purposefulness with which scenarios were pursued. Then in 2007, Polokwane occurred, and the government then looked at a different set of scenarios, which was the future we chose. And these scenarios looked at what will happen subsequent to Polokwane. Those scenarios suggested that subsequent to Polokwane, when we go to Mangaung, when we go to Nasrec, things will look could look very bad. And in fact, all those scenarios panned out in the way, in fact, to the date. And so between 2008 and 2021 up to now, there were no scenarios in government. So there was no mirror that the government could hold to itself to say what is happening. Of course, there was the NDP, but the NDP was not a plan. It was a vision of 340 pages, which were quite many. However, it needed to be digested to a plan. But this was the most undated. This was the most undated lady or gentleman, because it was only remembered when people went to ask for money from the treasury. They would quote the verse of the NDP that triple challenges of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. And then leave it there and do everything else but the NDP. So in 2016, a group of people came together and they said, given the kind of situation so bad in South Africa, what do we do? That was the best of the Inland Meeting scenarios, which had to themselves looked at the scenario of Gwaragwara, which is a nation of disorder. A scenario of Isibuzwa, which is a trickle-down economy, and then a Naira Walk scenario, which is the South Africa in step with itself. This said, there are a few things that will emerge in the economy that will be done in society, and those things, when they happen, you would know that you are in that particular scenario. For now, what we see and what we have seen in the last 2 years is a plunge into a Gwaragwara scenario.
So then how do we then change the future of a child that is born in this scenario 20 years from now, 30 years from now? What needs to happen?
Well, let me step back and say 27 years back from 1992, Nelson Mandela was in prison. 27 years today, we have had a democracy. In the Mandela month, ironically, we are in a month where we are deep in this nation of disorder and decay, which in itself, there is the scenario of Isibuzwa, which is the land of enclaves. And if you look at the images that were coming, racism is deepening because the way the attacks were quite racial, or as you saw them on camera, people were beating each other like dogs, particularly across race. It became very clear that the racial emotions were really driving this thing, meaning that the Rainbow Nation, the dream of a South Africa that is great, was gone. And so these are challenges that are very, very deep. The dream of a free South Africa, the dream of education for all, well-being for all, has just disappeared in front of us. Not that it ever existed with a lot of conviction or what have you, but that which was there has died under the weight of Gwarawara. But maybe we shouldn't waste a good
lesson.
A crisis,
yeah.
Because the crisis is here now. Whether we caused it or it was caused by somebody else, we've got to roll with the punches and get out of this scenario. So the question is, what does a child born today? What is the promise for the next 27 years? So I give you 27, 27, 27. In the future, that's 81 years. What will we write about South Africa when we get to its first year of its being since Mandela was jailed? That's the question. And perhaps one will say, it should be a country that is consistent with the NDP. Of course, the NDP is out of date in terms of in terms of the targets and the like, but in terms of what it intended, it captured the essence of the constitutional promise, but it didn't have a plan to execute that. So what do we do? What we do is just to look at the scenarios that we have out here and look at the scenario that we best think we should achieve. Now, what is unique about these scenarios? I know you've asked me what happens to a child born today. But I need to do a bit of, I don't even want to use the word introspection, but I need to say what is unique about the Indlamithi scenarios in contradistinction from the other earlier scenarios. The earlier scenarios were storylines about what could happen. The Indlamithi scenarios are scenarios, they have storylines. They have been quantified in terms of what drives them. Can you quantify them? They've been quantified. They've looked at the set of policies that will yield those kinds of outcomes and quantified and then modeled for the future as to what will happen if we desire a particular. So that's the distinct difference. And then they also are measured year in, year out as to where are we in relation to this. Those are the qualitative and quantitative differences between these scenarios and the previous ones. And they also anticipate a social compact, a cohesive South Africa. What would it look like? So it is following this particular, making the choices around these scenarios that will determine then what a child born today will look like in South Africa in another 27 years.
So even if we adopt a scenario and make a decision that this is what we would like the outcome of this child's future to look like, there are things that need to be in place. We need to have skilled people to implement these scenarios. We need to monitor, we need to plan, and so on. Do you think we have the capacity to do that with what we have right now?
Well, that's what is important in this scenario. They don't make any assumptions around. They look at the policies that we have, mm-hmm. and argue that if these policies are driven in this way, these are the outcomes that we will get. And if these policies that are drivers of change, and if those policies are not combined in a particular way, and those choices are not combined in a particular way, then you will not get the outcome. And the beauty of this is that they are looked at in different combinations, mm-hmm. and each combination yields a particular outcome. And it also depends on the orientation that you have mm-hmm. towards development. If your development is driven by a monetarist theory mm-hmm. and by Milton Friedman's monetarist free fundamental market fundamentalism, mm-hmm. you will never get the development that because those are the policies we have been following since 1994, with a tinge here and a tinge there. With us, these are, we saw changes when the government got interventionist. We saw changes, mm-hmm. and market fundamentalists say no. There's leave everything to us as the private sector. Government should be a referee, must facilitate, but the private sector must generate jobs and do all those kinds of things. When the U.S. got into a crisis, they intervened, they used Keynesian economics, and they made things work for society. If you looked at Biden, he said there must be jobs, 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 and he put a lot of resources as government to doing that.
So
the scenarios that we have look at the different options. Mm-hmm. If government intervenes, yes, then you are okay. If you leave it to the markets, there's no change that will occur. In fact, we will have a socially incohesive country.
So then let's look at those policies. Have we had enough interrogation? And when I say that, I mean by everybody in adopting these policies. Or do we have a select few that have been the people who've adopted policies that we assume will work for everybody else, and therefore we find ourselves not being able to realize the dream? Have we done enough to have most of society adopt the policy that actually works for all of us? Not all of us, but relatively for a nation that has a specific outcome that they wish for.
Well, in a democracy, you do these things through parliament. But you know that parliamentary democracy is a farce. We know that the same party that we have protected the person that they ousted after 12 years or after 9 years, which is President Zuma. And they protected him for all the other years from being ousted by parliament. And when their schemes were close to the fire, then they decided to oust them in parliament. So parliamentary democracy is a farce unless you have active citizenry. And active citizenry is facilitated by a process of scenario building, consensus building around the scenarios, consensus building about the outcomes. And the absence of scenarios means that you cannot mobilize society towards that objective that ensures that parliamentary democracy doesn't become a farce, but becomes beneficial to society because they are actively engaged and they can know the outcomes of that engagement. In the absence of scenarios, you end up with what we got, which is the Reconstruction and Recovery Plan, which promises you, if you look at that Recovery and Reconstruction Plan, it doesn't have indicators of unemployment by 2030. Mm-hmm. Which is a diversion mm-hmm. from NDP. Of mm-hmm. course, NDP has been filed long ago, mm-hmm. but NDP said by 2030 we must have 6% unemployment. Mm-hmm. The Reconstruction and Recovery Plan doesn't give you a 6% unemployment. Mm-hmm. In fact, it is silent on that target. It is silent on inequality. It is also silent on poverty, except delivering platitudes around, we'll reduce unemployment, we'll reduce this, we'll reduce that. In the absence of solid targets, you cannot believe that that is achievable. The only thing that that reconstruction and development plan does is to tell you how much growth you might get. Now, yes, growth you need, but growth you can't eat unless it is inclusive. So these are the problems that we have in the current system, that these things are not modeled, they are not negotiated in a way that everybody sees the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But Parliament applauds and says, we pass this.
Mm-hmm.
Then Turok died with his shoes on in November 2019, saying, don't approve the MTVPS because it's doomed to fail.
Mm-hmm.
So unless we change our orientation to policy design and getting all the policies together, we'll end up with these kinds of problems. And we shouldn't complain when we have made the choices, because these things that is Kwarawara now or Isibuzwa are choices. We shouldn't get surprised, and we shouldn't complain because we have made those choices. So it's very, very important to understand each path and the outcome of that path at any point in time is a consequence of an earlier choice. The problem is this. The poor might have not chosen to be poor, but somebody chooses on their behalf to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
How do we change that scenario?
You've got to change that by looking at the scenarios, because without scenarios, surely, we will not know where we are going. Without scenarios, we don't have the discussion power, the negotiation power, the consultative processes, the design of the promise. The NDP was negotiated, discussed, and the promise was clear. The problem with the NDP, it was only one scenario. It was, this is the road, but it didn't have the road marks and the curve and saying slow down there, drive faster there.
Mm-hmm.
When you have three scenarios or four scenarios, you know when you are gravitating to the wrong side.
Mm.
And you need all those, like a gauge on the car, the dashboard on the car. It shows you when the petrol is going, it's going to get finished. If it only had a needle that sits, shows you when it is full, you'll never know when it is empty. So the NDP was like a monotonic dashboard, one-sided dashboard. But you need all this with all the signals so that you know where you are gravitating towards. The scenarios generate language, and that language then mobilizes society. You see, one of the things that are very critical in the design of governments or national or state citizens systems, it's the politics. There must be a politically mobilizing philosophy. That's very, very important. And that politically mobilizing philosophy must be socially desirable, should be leading to a socially desirable end, and must mobilize resources to make that socially desirable end possible. All those things, call them Venn diagrams, all those things must sit one on top of the other. If each circle is sitting on its own, then you know that we are heading for disaster. And in South Africa, we are having all those concentric circles, or those circles, sitting apart from one the other. The politics are actually driving us to a politically undesirable. It's not a politically mobilizing philosophy that we have in South Africa. We have a socially undesirable end that we have moved towards, and with an economically unfeasible solution. Now, you need to bring those things together.
Yes, Thokozani, good evening. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
No problem. Thank you, Pamela. Thank you, Doctor. Doctor, I just want to ask you a question, right? Given that the situation that we found was that we find ourselves in right now, it's a political one, right? My question is, when the Gwaragwara and the Isibuzwa models were forecasted, What at that point in time were key political variables that were actually used, to actually forecast, those eventualities? And then the second question is that those models, when they were stress tested, right? And basically in reference to those political variables that I asked earlier on, right? What were those stress tests about? And what were those stress tests also based on as well?
I think the voice has not been very clear. Perhaps if you can reread the question, it will help me.
Thokozani, just come closer to your speaker so that we can get you clearer. You can definitely go ahead and repeat your question, Thokozani.
Okay. Okay. Is my voice clear now, Doctor?
Yes, it is clear.
Okay. So my question, Doctor, is that when the Guaraguara and the AC Bourgeois scenario planning were formulated or when they were constructed, right? Given that the current problem that we're facing is a political problem, right? So my question is that at that point in time, what were the key political variables, okay, that were used, okay, to basically construct those models and also stress test those models?
I see. Okay, yes. I mean, the scenarios in themselves are based on research and expert views, all of us are experts, and we express our views as to what path is the country likely to follow and what will inform that particular path. Once we have said the outcome is Guaraguara, you have to say what are the things that will drive us towards that path. The indicators are both economic, political, and social that govern that kind of particular process. So in the research that we did to inform these scenarios, we classified, therefore, these outcomes as Guaraguara, as Naila Walk, and as Isi Bourgeois. And we then determined how are we going to get to any one of these outcomes. And those paths are like, for instance, if poverty reaches this particular level, if inequality reaches this level, if employment reaches that level, if GDP growth does that, if society is caring, and all those who are brought in. And now, in terms of the reality of the country, it was clear that we were heading towards a Guaraguara. The previous years...
Sorry, Doctor. My question is specific on the variables. Remember, you mentioned three variables, political, social, and economic variables. My question is specific on the key political variables, okay?
Oh, yes. The political variables, it was about leadership. Leadership doesn't exist, we are going to head into Guaraguara. Therefore, Guaraguara is a consequence of poor leadership or lack of leadership.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And maybe, sorry, if I may be blunt in my questioning. Did Guaraguara, in the focus of us having this situation that we find ourselves in, did it sort of like incorporate Zuma as a potential political leader leading into the disaster that the country was going to have in the future? Was that the political variable?
Well, the political variable of leadership engulfs all leadership, not only the political leadership. The breakdown in political leadership, breakdown in leadership in churches, breakdown in the leadership in government, breakdown in leadership in private sector. Mm. What Zondo is revealing is that leadership broke completely in private sector. I mean, if you look at Steinhoff's, you see the same thing. If you look at Gupta and Zuma, see the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at all these things, are typical that there was total breakdown at the level of leadership. And that's the Guaraguara. And then if you look at the rail lines that are being scooped all the time, and then you look at the the looting. I mean, senior officials, senior what comes out of Zondo is that those with ties and jackets loot. And then when the poor loot, it's called looting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the poor are doing. They are doing what the those with ties do in a much more sophisticated in private air conditioned offices.
They emulate.
These ones do it in the open, and it's called an act of vandalism. It is indeed, and in both cases, they are acts of vandalism, and that's what the Guarawara scenario does.
Thank you so much for that, Tokozani, and I also have to thank you very, very much, Dr. Paddy Lehlohotla, who is a former statistician general and member of Indlulamaiti, and I know that there is a conversation that's going to be happening tomorrow. We'll put that on our social media platform. Thank you very much, Dr. Lehlohotla.
Thank you very much. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, too.
1 o'clock.
Thank you. Thanks for calling, Silo. You calling from Soweto. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling, Silo.
Yeah, thanks for welcoming me also into your show.
You're welcome.
Very, very well structured. And I've been listening to Dr. Lehlohotla expressing all this very, very complicated stuff, but I just want to speak on simple terms, if allowed, and I want to be very
clear. Of course you're allowed.
Yes, because I'm not an academic, you know.
No, there is room for everybody. Of course you're allowed, Silo. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm in a field of training, and I've been looking at really what is taking place right now in our country.
Mm.
And I think the crux of the matter is accountability in leadership, issues of consequence management that are not taken seriously. And for us, it's looking into the future now. How is it that we're going to lay a new foundation? We can speak of economic reforms and all these other political reforms, you know, and look at the type of paradigm shift that we want to achieve right now. But what does it mean to the young ones right now that must carry the baton in future, I mean, in the next 10 to 20 to 15 years? And we need to go back to the drawing board, you know, as society. And it is good and well and good to see when our communities are now, you know, taking hold and ownership of our own community amenities, resources, you know, protecting our heritage, like your Maponya malls, you know, which is the only mall standing in Soweto for that matter. And I also want to say we really appreciate what the young people are doing there in Pimville, and also supported, you know, by adults also. But the important thing is, how do we then take the very same values entrenched in our constitution and not just make them a curriculum that will be collecting dust as it is right now? How do we express this into our homes? How do we make it this value chain to really make sense? Because that comes with the fundamentals of how we as society impart the knowledge, the values that are interested in the constitution, such that when these young people are adults, we're able to have accountability,
mm-hmm.
we're able to accept consequence management issues or consequence to behavior that was not of desired quality insofar as leadership is concerned. So right now we need decisive leadership. We have seen the soldiers deployed. We have seen the police running out of, you know, control. And as soon as the soldiers are there, then the matter is, you know, the community, the pressure subsides. You understand? But we need, for me, it's a question of maybe prior to a decision of a Concord, there should have been lockdown, level 5. Such that there is control insofar as that is concerned. Because then it means once we're locked down completely,
it will be those who are challenging the state and the state in the streets only. Everybody else is at home and is safe. So there was going to be better control. Now we're sitting in a point where there's so much consultation taking place and very little action on the ground. I mean, we've been looking since from the president's address on Monday. Yesterday, another consultation, media briefings, consultation, media briefings, assessment on the ground. They're assessing, and that's all the leadership is doing. There's no accountability, and no one is and there's also no consequential plan, not only for those that are committing crimes on the ground or for those that are suspect of instigating these things, but also the type of leadership that is taking cause, that is responsible for the type of government that we are seeing right now.
Silla there in Soweto, thank you so much for that. Clem Santer is also joining us this evening for a conversation on scenario planning. Clem, we are here. Would you consider this a moment of opportunity? I know it's a difficult moment, but would you see this as a moment of opportunity?
Absolutely, and thank you for having me on your show. I see it as a great moment of opportunity to really look at what can actually now help us out of this dreadful moment which showed how desperate a lot of people are, that they've not got jobs and they've suffered through the whole COVID pandemic. And please, like your previous caller said, we must hold people accountable for looting and destruction. But, you know, we have to transform our economy. And I've been saying for a very long time that we need to have an entrepreneurial revolution where we put total focus on small business and how we can assist all the incredible entrepreneurs in the townships and elsewhere come into the mainstream economy. And, you know, you need a frightening moment like this to get people to understand that we need this radical shift in our economy. And the first thing I think Cyril should do is set up a council of CEOs and entrepreneurs who founded businesses and actually use them just like the COVID Council, because the challenge to get our economy back on track is just as big as the challenge of handling the coronavirus. And we need leadership from the top, but we also need a sort of ground-up revolution where municipalities realize that the only way they're going to create jobs is to have a climate for new small businesses to flourish.
You speak about having to look at a crisis in the eye and have a frightening moment. Will this frightening moment be frightening for a critical mass that we require to move to the next level?
Well, you know, I don't think people, you know, everyone's concentrating just on watching the looting and stuff from the shops. The longer term situation is pretty awful to contemplate because, you know, how long is it going to take to sort of rebuild the malls that have been damaged and actually persuade, you know, shop owners to stock goods again? And you know, I don't think people realize, you know, how long it's going to take to get life back to normal. And because we are in a very interdependent world now, what happens in KZN and what happens in Gauteng affects all the other provinces in terms of the supply chain. So, you know, it's not so much this moment which is going to make people think. It's actually the next phase when, you know, people are going to say, wow, you know, it's now 6 months or a year since this mall was damaged. When are the you know, the shop owners and the entrepreneurs going to come back? And that's why you need a conversation right now about the recovery scenario from this, because it's going to take time.
But Clem, you know, government and the private sector always have a funny dance, in the sense that you know you have these investment summits and so on, and then they would come and say, we pledge so much money, but the big questions are not really asked or interrogated. So nobody asks if this is new money or just recycling money. So in other words, if the business anyway needed to replenish their equipment, they anyway were going to spend that money. It's not new. It's just that they present it to us as if it's new. What I'm really asking is, to what extent are we going to have real commitment, truthful commitment from all quarters to move us to where we need to go?
Well, I've just published a new book through Penguin called Thinking the Future. And one of the chapters, the second last chapter of this book, is about thinking and doing. And we have giants who we explore in each chapter. And the two principal giants of the chapter on thinking and doing are Nelson Mandela and Steve Jobs. Because both of them said that, just having visions and thinking didn't get you anywhere. The way you change the world is to combine the two. And unfortunately, all these summits and everything else we've had have been very much in the thinking and talking phase. We haven't had the real doing. And for me, the most important thing is to set goals on how we're going to provide microfinance to all the new enterprises that can be opened up in South Africa. How can we open little stock exchanges, e-stock exchanges around the country in every single municipality? How can we make big companies commit part of their supply chain to nurturing entrepreneurs? We've got to come up with about 10 to 20 targets, and then Cyril has to actually do what he's doing now with the pandemic, of appearing on TV and elsewhere and saying, this is where we've got to in terms of the recovery process. He needs to give as much attention to that as getting us through the pandemic.
Isn't part of the problem, though, that we also were very willing to accept whatever plan government has? So, for instance, with the State of the Nation address, the government would say, or himself, the president would say, well, we will create plus minus 1 to 2 million jobs a year, when we know that that's not enough to get us to where we need to go to. We don't challenge that. We just simply applaud at the end of the speech.
Yeah, and the point is this: is you've just mentioned, one of the statements that you can no longer make because the nature of work has changed since the last century. Mm-hmm. It's another issue we address in this book, which is that, in the last century you could have big projects. We had a huge mining industry. We had big companies creating hundreds of thousands of jobs and stuff like that. But technology in the form of automation and robots and artificial intelligence means that everywhere in the world, not just South Africa, the majority of jobs are being created are in small enterprise. The latest statistic in America to come out of the Small Business Institute there is that two-thirds of the jobs there are being created in the small businesses. So Cyril shouldn't talk about creating 2 million jobs. That is just no longer possible with all the latest technologies. We've got to talk about how many new businesses are being created around the country and how many entrepreneurs in all the townships and all the rural areas are being created, because that is the only way now we're going to create 5 to 10 million jobs. They're simply not going to be created by the kind of big projects that we had in the last century.
So what kind of pressure do we need to apply? Because we also know that the environment is very hostile to an entrepreneur. We know that it is tedious. The red tape there is just incredible. And so when we talk about creating small little jobs and in small little businesses, we also know that, for instance, the Ministry of Small Business couldn't keep up with the demand during the pandemic. what kind of pressure then needs to happen for that to happen?
Yeah, well, I would say this, you know, as I was saying, that this is this event, you know, we've just seen the start of it. You know, we've been watching with horror all the scenes of looting and destruction on TV. But that's not the sort of the end of it, because, you know, where are people once the food is consumed? Where are they going to shop? Because, you know, that particular mall is no longer exists. You know, we're about to enter an incredible time of economic hardship, and the only way the government is going to, you know, begin to restore hope again in this country is to come up with a completely new plan about business formation and how they can help entrepreneurs to create new jobs. And obviously, one of the things that has happened in this country with great success has been franchises, where a person doesn't just open up a new business alone. He's become part of the network, like Spar and other big companies. So, you know, the pressure is really going to be on to have a fundamental debate about you know, how we create, as one of the scenarios in the book is called, a people's economy. And a people's economy is one where ordinary people have every chance of becoming an entrepreneur. And we've got so much talent in this country. And we created, you know, the second richest person in the world. That's Elon Musk. He was South African. He was educated at Pretoria Boys High. And now he's the second richest man in the world, second richest person in the world.
Yes, but Clem,
you know, we've got all this talent.
But that talent wasn't good enough in this country. You also know that he became that in a different environment.
Yes, in the American environment,
correct,
which encourages mm-hmm. entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what separates America and, you know, for a long time from Europe and you know, other places around the world, is that it's been at the center of the essence of the American system, that people look after themselves, start their own businesses. You know, one of the incredible things is how many jobs Americans have. Some Americans have two or three jobs where they do, you know, Airbnb, and then they go and serve in a pizza parlor and they do this. That's why we have to have this fundamental debate about how we can transform this economy. And I know I'm sounding a bit like Julius Malema, but I am an economic freedom fighter because I believe in freedom for entrepreneurs. And you know, we've got to really, really, really get down to creating that kind of economy. And that's why I want Cyril to have a little council of, you know, people who founded companies like Adrian Gore founded Discovery and other people like that, who can say to him, if you want to create people like me, this is what you've got to do. And then he's got to do it. And we've all got to get together to support him in terms of the banks providing microfinance and, as I said, big companies nurturing small businesses, possibly taking some of the, you know, old stadiums and turning them into places where small businesses can display their goods and stuff like that. We've got to come up with a whole new list of ideas of how to help the real talent that exists in this country turn that talent into new enterprises. And we're not seeing that. Nobody's discussing that because there isn't the same passion here, as you rightly say, as there is in America for, you know, business innovation.
Independent scenario planner Clem Santag there. All right, that brings us to the end of the show. It's been very, very full. Thank you so much for all of you who have been a part of this conversation. We'll continue that again tomorrow.
Kaya Talk on Kaya 959.
On the street, on the air.